Les séminaires du Collège de France.
We are very happy to welcome today my great friend, Professor Siddhartha Ribeiro, who is coming specially from Brazil for us for a few days. Siddhartha is a scientist with many talents. He's also a writer. He's a capoeira dancer and professor, but we will not speak about that today, maybe not. But he's a deputy director and was one of the founders of the Brain Institute in Natal at the Universidade Federal do Rio Grande do Norte. I hope my accent is not so
mal.
Pas mal. And he is well known for his long-time research on sleep and dreams and learning, of which he will talk about. But we first met also because he has been founding organizer of a very important school for brain and education sciences, which was in Latin America, and to which we participated eagerly, and I think it was responsible for training a large number of students all across the world, not just in Latin America, on education, and is in great part responsible for my own engagement in education. So thank you, Siddhartha, for that. And Siddhartha also has other talents. Marcela Peña is here, is also one of the organizers of the Latin American School, together with Mariano Sigman and Ale from Uruguay. I was just saying also that Professor Siddhartha Ribeiro has many other talents. His lab is actively engaged in understanding the brain mechanisms of psychedelics. And this is a very interesting and hot area of research because there are therapeutic effects in psychiatry that are only now being rediscovered, and their impact can be major on depression, on PTSD, post-traumatic syndrome. So understanding how they work at the brain level is really important, and Siddhartha published some important papers on plasticity and how plasticity has been enhanced or restored by some psychedelics. And I mention that because he's author of several books that you may find. The one is in English, should be translated by Odile Jacob at some point. It's called The Oracle of the Night, L'Oracle de la Nuit. This is, of course, the history and science of dreaming. It's a very good book. And the new book, which is just appearing next week, actually, in Paris. I'm looking at my notes to get the title absolutely right. It's a great title, by the way. It's called Les Fleurs du Bien. Les Fleurs du Bien, Science et Histoire de la Libération du Cannabis. So it's a history of this research on psychedelics, and in particular, of course, cannabis. So if you want to be there next week on Wednesday, mercredi 19 février à 19h30 à la librairie Le Mont-en-L'Air, Siddhartha présentera son livre et discutera des données qui sont présentées dans ce livre, Les Fleurs du Bien. Voilà. It's appearing in French, it's already available in Portuguese, and it will be available in English as well very soon. But today we are talking about dreams and sleep, and without further ado, Siddhartha will tell us all about it. Thank you, Siddhartha.
Merci beaucoup, Stan. Bonjour à tous. Mon français c'est très limité, so I will switch to English. I apologize for that. It's a pleasure to be here with you. This is the logo of my laboratory. My laboratory is called Laboratory of Memory, Sleep and Dreams. This was made by an artist, an indigenous artist called Querétio Martin from the Guarani Mbia group, to represent dream. Dream in Guarani Mbia, the word for dream means I see myself. I just want to take a moment to remember our dear colleague Yves Regnac, who passed away recently. He was one of the greatest neuroscientists of vision at Gif-sur-Yvette. He was also a very good friend. He was a member of our scientific committee. This is the part of a scientific committee of our institute with our director, Kerstin Schmidt, and Professor Thorsten Wieso, Professor Claudio Melo, and Professor Charles Gilbert. Today we're going to talk about memory, sleep, and dreams, and we have to remember that we all go through different phases of sleep that have an interesting relationship to dreaming. When we enter sleep, when we are in the N1 phase, we have hypnagogic dreaming. We have this entrance into sleep that is accompanied by dreaming. Then we go into N2 and N3 states, which are very, very good for resting, for the regeneration of the body, but there's very little dreaming. There's some dreaming going on, but not much. And then we go into REM sleep, or paradoxical sleep, as it's preferred here in France, when we have very intense dreaming. And dreaming and sleep pose a very interesting conundrum, because it's the moment when we are absolutely vulnerable to predation. So you cannot really protect yourself when you're sleeping. And so it must be very important, otherwise it wouldn't have evolved. And it has evolved a long time ago. As soon as there were multicellular animals, probably the universal kind of sleep, so-called quiet sleep, probably evolved, because all animals have it. And this is a moment when we rest. This is a moment when we do a lot of protein synthesis, hormone liberation, and usually, as I said before, with very little dreaming going on. On top of quiet sleep, there's also an active form of sleep when our nervous systems are quite active, and this is probably also very old, because you can see this, for example, in cephalopods. Actually, our lab was the first to show that this active kind of sleep occurs in a very periodic manner, brief but very periodic episodes across the period of sleep. There's a flurry of activity in this area now, and people are showing that many invertebrates have some form of active sleep. This is the case of the Drosophila. So we're also talking about a very, very old, probably very old evolution. And in vertebrates, it has been shown that active sleep exists in reptiles, in birds, and of course, in mammals. Perhaps the main difference between mammals and all the other groups is that our active sleep episodes, which we call REM sleep, are very long. So if the octopus or the birds or the lizards are dreaming, they're dreaming of very short scenes, something like a GIF, rather than a real movie or a real a complex experience like we have. In the late 50s, the great Michel Jouvet showed that if you lesion a deep part of the brain near the locus coeruleus in the pons, you can disinhibit muscles during REM sleep, because when we are in REM sleep, most of our bodies are most of our muscles are inhibited. We don't show any behavior, any overt behavior. But if those lesions are made, cats will perform species-specific behaviors. They will seem to enact dreams. They will do pouncing, they will do pursue, things that they would do normally in their normal life, they will also do that during REM sleep. And this became a strong argument for saying that most likely animals are actually experiencing dreaming when they are in REM sleep. The search for the function of dreaming led to a theory called the threat simulation theory that was proposed by Antti Revonsuo and Katja Valli and colleagues in Finland. They were comparing the dreams of children in the Kurdistan during the Saddam Hussein regime with dreams of Finnish children. And they showed something that is quite obvious, in fact, that the children living in a war area have many more nightmares. And of course, obvious things need to be shown and published, because they will allow us to move forward with our thoughts. And this led them to propose that perhaps the most ancient form of dreaming, and perhaps the original function of dreaming, was to warn dreamers about the impending threats of the future. And this is why they proposed this threat simulation theory. This idea actually has a good match with the phenomenology of dreaming in our society. So across various studies, has been shown that between 30 and 50% of dreams involve some sort of negative emotion, whether it's just an anxious dream or a dream that involves some stress or an actual, you know, full-flare nightmare. And nightmares occur weekly in 4 to 10% of the population. So if it's interesting to realize that when we look for the earliest records of dreaming in human history, if we go back to the Mesopotamian literature, among the earliest texts of humanity, you already have dream reports, and those dream reports are often about nightmares that are bad omens, that somehow warn against an impending threat. For example, the dream of Dumuzid, this mythological shepherd that had a dream that he was going to be persecuted by foreign men that ended up being demons and take him to the underworld and torture him. A horrible story. There are plenty of examples of this kind of dream in the literature of the Bronze Age and the Antiquity in general, in the Middle Ages including. For example, the famous dreams that Calpurnia and her husband Julius Caesar had on March 14th of 44 BC. She had this very literal dream that he was going to go meet the senators and be stabbed to death, which is exactly what happened. In the old times, people used to call this a theorematic dream, a very direct literal dream. And he had a very different dream. He dreamt that he was flying through the skies, and he met Jupiter, and Jupiter greeted him warmly. And his advisor said, "Oh, this is such a nice dream." And he didn't pay attention to his wife and got killed. But the dream, in fact, was talking about the same thing in a very metaphorical manner. The way to become a divine being in the Roman society was to die. I mean, it wouldn't happen to people that were alive. So, in a way, you know, meeting Jupiter was like a bad omen as well. This tradition was lost. The tradition of paying attention to those omens was lost in the European culture in the past 500 years, but not so in indigenous cultures. For example, the Lakota, the Cheyenne, the Arapaho, in the 19th century, fighting the U.S. forces that were invading their lands and supporting the gold miners to invade their lands, they used dreams to defend themselves. So Sitting Bull had this very famous dream in which he realized they were going to be attacked by Lieutenant Colonel Custer's troops, and this allowed them to make a trap for those troops, and this was the worst defeat of the U.S. Army up to that point. And this is a depiction of that conflict by Standing Bear, a Lakota chief. The fact that our Western culture doesn't give much value to dreams doesn't mean that they don't impact our society. So, for example, Elias Howe, trying to invent a sewing machine, had a dream of savages carrying spears with holes in the ends, and this gave him the idea the next day to invent the first lock-stitch sewing machine, which really revolutionized the economy at the time. And in science, we could not be... it's the same story. In science, there are many examples in which dreaming was very inspirational. The famous dream that Kekule had about the Ouroboros, the snake that eats its own tail, that led him to understand the circular structure of benzene. The fact that Mendeleev came up with the organization of the periodic table through a dream, I mean, that's amazingly influential. I believe everybody here had to learn the periodic table at some point. And then Otto Loewi got the Nobel Prize for an experiment that he envisioned during dreaming, which allowed him to show the role of acetylcholine in controlling cardiac function. In the arts, there's even many more examples, all great books from Cervantes to Shakespeare to you name it, involve dreaming, involve sleep and dreaming. And in particular, Salvador Dalí is a good example because he transformed this into a method for creation. He would stand sitting with a heavy spoon in his hand, wait for the muscle atonia to hit him, and then when the spoon hit the floor, he was woken by that sound, and he would then paint what he was seeing. This is a famous painting entitled Dream Caused by the Flight of a Bee Around a Pomegranate a Second Before Awakening. It's almost like a material methods section of a paper. Now, as I mentioned before, indigenous populations keep the ancient art of dreaming alive, and they use it not just for personal guidance, but for collective guidance. So among the Xavante, some of the most ancient populations in South America, among the Yanomami, also very old in the Amazon, dreaming is a community effort, and the Xavante actually have a dream circle at the center of the village, so they come together every morning to do collective interpretation of dreaming. In the Western tradition, dreaming was really, really dismissed throughout the 17th, 18th, and 19th century. Descartes, for example, had amazing dreams that inspired him to create analytical geometry, but then later on he said, no, this was all nonsense. But this all changed at the very end of the 19th century when Sigmund Freud published the Interpretation of Dreams. And I know it's very heretical to talk about Freud in good terms here, but I will do so. Freud proposed in this amazing book, very well written book, that dreams contain day residues. Therefore, what he was saying is that dreams reflect what happens in the waking life. He also said that dreams are driven by desires and fears. And then he said that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. What does he mean with that? Sounds like poetry, doesn't sound like science at all. And it was not treated as science for many years. He didn't say that we learn during sleep or that sleep helps learning. But when he said that dreams contain day residues, that was implied, because if we learn during the day and then we go to sleep and there are day residues, then those day residues are probably related to learning. This idea was not followed up immediately, but then in 1924, about 100 years ago, Jenkins and Dalaba published the first evidence that sleep helps learning. And they were replicating the famous forgetting curve, the Ebbinghaus curve, but they compared the same subjects having access to a nap or not. And what they showed is that when people were able to sleep after learning, in this case, some non-existing syllables in their language, they perform much better. So somehow sleep protected those memories from interference. This was seen for many years as evidence for passive role of sleep in protecting memories, but now we know that sleep is not passive at all, it's very active, it's doing a lot of things to memories. And this actually was shown to a large extent here in France. So this finding was not followed up for many decades, but then in the late 60s, in those five Mirabilis years between 69 and 74, there were many publications in France and also in the United States showing that sleep deprivation impairs learning and also showing that sleep increases following memory acquisition. But then during the 70s and 80s, this field became very acrimonious. People were really fighting and shouting at each other during meetings because a lot of people were not able to accept these results because they said, well, you sleep deprive an animal, the animal is stressed. Therefore, what you're seeing is not an effect of sleep, but an effect of stress. And this was solved in the year 2000. It took many decades to solve this issue. In this paper by Bob Stickold from Harvard, in which he showed that they were teaching a visual discrimination task, so they were showing lots of letters and you had to find a particular letter, a T or an L, with many, many letters to confound you for only 17 milliseconds. And they were able to show that if you train once and allow people to sleep, they will show incremental gains across days. But if you sleep deprive them between days 0 and 1, and then you test them on day 3, they are impaired. But they are no longer tired, they're no longer stressed. And therefore, that sleep night was really important. It's amazing how long it took to do this experiment and for people to be convinced, but this was the paper that really moved things forward. After that, it became, because until then it was sort of a career-ending decision to study sleep-dependent learning, but then that changed, and then many, many publications came after that. For example, the group of Jan Born, originally in Lübeck and now in Tübingen, showed that sleep promotes insights into a hidden structure, hidden numerical structure. And then also the lab of Sarah Mednick has shown that the time you spend in REM sleep is associated with solving problems, linguistic problems that require you to find remote associates, so some form of linguistic creativity or verbal creativity. And then Isabelle Arnouf and Delphine Oudiet here have shown that, and Andrion, my colleagues here, have shown that in fact this N1 stage, the hypnagogic sleep, is also very good for that. As they say, is a sweet spot for creativity. All that is about sleep, time in REM sleep, type in N1 sleep. What about dreaming? The first evidence that dreaming is also important for learning was shown in 2010 in the laboratory of Bob Stickold in an experiment done by Erin Walmsley. They trained subjects to navigate a maze, and they showed that if you then stay some time awake and do the task again, you don't improve much. But if you sleep during that time, and if you dream about the game, about the task, then you improve. If you sleep and don't dream, you don't improve. So this was the first evidence that agrees with the Amazonian shamans, that the dreaming is actually very important. So inspired by all that, in my laboratory, we decided to follow up with education. As Stan mentioned, the La School, the Latin American School of Education, really motivated many of us to look in that direction. And then we were the first to do NAP experiments in the school environment and show that there is a gain. The first study showed that it's not that the children learn more. So on day one, they learned the same, whether they had a NAP or not. But then on day two, those that didn't have a NAP decreased. And then on day five, the contents are retained by those that had a nap, but not by those that were awake. So in this case, naps are not really enhancing learning, but they are protecting that learning to go away. We replicated that later, showing that long naps, not short naps, so naps that are above 30 minutes, will have that effect. And then more recently, together with my dear friend and colleague Felipe Pegador here at Sorbonne, we designed an experiment, and he worked with Stan, and we actually used some thinking that came from Stan's lab, that we could train 5-6-year-old children to discriminate the so-called mirror letters, the letters that that change depending on the orientation. So for example, the B and the D, the P and the Q, the S and the Z. We could train them to discriminate those letters and then apply a NAP and see if we could get them to acquire literacy in a more efficient manner. We compared that training plus NAP group with a training-only group, and then with two kinds of control. The negative control didn't get anything, just the regular classes, and the active control, in which they were trained to discriminate letters, but they were symmetrical, so the A, the O, the M, and then therefore there was no content there. And what we found is that the training worked in both groups, the blue and the red, so they learned to discriminate those letters, but then over time that was lost in the blue group. But it was not lost in the red group, and in fact, it 4 months later, that it was associated with a huge increase in reading speed. So the red group has twice the speed of reading than the other groups. What this is telling us is that if you don't add a nap to the after the class, most likely everything you learn will be forgotten sometime later. And in fact, if we ask anybody on the street what they remember from high school, it's actually very little. Perhaps we need to bring naps back to all schools. And that's a very cost-effective change to do. Okay, so this is the phenomenology of sleep and dreaming in a nutshell. What about the mechanisms? What's responsible for all that? One good way to think about this problem is to go back to this amazing, beautiful book, The Organization of Behavior, by Donald Hebb, published in 1949, in which he said that a memorable event, a memory encoding event, in order for it to generate a long-term memory, needs to generate two different processes which are sequential. The first one he labeled neuronal reverberation. It means your brain needs to deal with this new information as it is, with the collection of molecules that it has at this moment. It needs to somehow electrically reverberate this memory. But then after some time, this process needs to subside, and it needs to give rise to what he calls structural change, which we would call nowadays synaptic plasticity or neuroplasticity, because we cannot keep all our memories electrically active, right? If you had all the memories that you have in your mind active at this very moment, you would be in utter confusion. So we need to have a vast collection, a vast database of latent memories, but we can only deal with a few active memories at a time. The first evidence, the first empirical evidence that such a thing occurs at the level of the neuronal reverberation or electrical reverberation was this classical experiment by Konstantin Pavlidis and Jonathan Winson at Rockefeller University, in which they investigated neurons in the dorsal hippocampus of a rat that have place fields. They respond to specific parts of the environment. And they had yoked pairs of neurons in which one neuron was highly active during the waking experience because they constrained the animal to that space, to that area of the space, and the other neuron was not active because the animal was not in that place field. And what they observed is that the exposed neurons, the neurons that were most active during the waking experience, were also more active during slow wave sleep and REM sleep, the two main phases of rodent sleep. So I like to say that this was the first demonstration of an electrophysiological day residue. This was soon followed up by this very, very iconic paper by Matt Wilson and Bruce McNaughton. I think everybody in the sleep field knows this image here. And they had an animal that was sleeping, and this was in particular in this case, slow wave sleep, in the pre-phase. And you can see every neuron they recorded in the dorsal hippocampus is a black dot, and the lines connecting the dots are the synchrony patterns, the correlations. Then they run a maze, and you see that a new pattern emerges, and this new pattern has very strong correlations, and you can see like a big triangle in the middle. And then they go to sleep again in the post-task phase, also slow wave sleep, and you can see that the pattern changes, but it's reminiscent of that waking pattern. So there's a replay going on there. Actually, I think this is the paper that really made the word sleep replay become very well known. Now, if you look at that pattern, it doesn't look like a perfect replay at all. But we have to remember that the neurons in the hippocampus, they carry multiple hats. They do multiple things. They're not involved in the representation of any single object. But if you go for neurons that actually care for a single object, then you can have perfect replay. This is the case of neurons in the RA nucleus of the songbird called zebrafinch. These neurons are responsible for coding the syllables that the animals sing, and they sing the same exact song throughout their lives. And what you see there is a representation of the song. The y-axis is the frequency, the x-axis is the time, and the brightness is the power. And you can see, so if you record a given neuron there in RA and the animal sings, this neuron will have a certain firing pattern. So this particular neuron will fire 3 bursts in the first syllable, then another burst, then 4 bursts, then 1 burst, and a final burst. And if the animal sings 100 times the same song, the neuron will fire exactly the same pattern. Now, what happens when the animal is sleeping? Pretty much the same pattern arises again. One could dispute whether the animal is dreaming about its own song, but I'm convinced the animal is actually very much dreaming of that. In my own laboratory, in my own career, I investigated this issue by investigating rats recording from the hippocampus, from the visual cortex, from the somatosensory cortex, and having them explore an environment with new objects, but with no visible light. So they had to use their whiskers, and we were recording in the somatosensory cortex fields, the barophils that responds to those whiskers. And what we found is that if you look at the larger time scale, not of minutes, but of hours, and there's a huge increase in firing rates only in the cerebral cortex that is related to the experience, that is somatosensory. We don't see that in the visual cortex that was not engaged in the task. And this was one of the earliest evidences that, in fact, there's some form of hippocampal disengagement and cortical engagement during post-training sleep. Of course, I'm talking here about firing rates or synchrony of firing between neurons. These are action potentials, very fast events. But they're happening on top of slower oscillations, right? And there are multiple oscillations that have an impact on sleep-dependent learning. So there's the very slow oscillation, there's the cortical spindle, the sharp wave ripples, and I believe there are many colleagues here that produce seminal work on this, and the Zugahor lab, Girardot lab, showing that this connection between the hippocampus and the cortex is mediated by those fast oscillations called ripples on top of sharp waves that are connected to the sleep spindles in the cortex. Also, theta activity, this is 5 to 7 hertz activity originating from the interaction between hippocampus and septum. All that has a strong impact on sleep-dependent learning, and PGO waves, which are also very important for that. But I'm not going to go into this because we have a lot of territory to cover, just to mention that this is very important. Also very important are the neurotransmitters that can modulate those processes. And there's recent evidence that both for dopamine that is liberated from the ventral tegmental area that spreads through the mesocortical limbic pathways and regulate reward and punishment, regulate whether a certain goal-directed behavior had a good outcome or a bad outcome. They are reactivated during sleep and they change the learning. And also, noradrenaline produced by the locus coeruleus also has a strong impact on the sleep-dependent learning. So far, we've been focusing on animal models, non-human animal models, because, of course, it's very difficult to do invasive electrophysiology, for example, in humans. It can be done, but it's hard. A protocol was designed in the past 20 years that is called targeted memory reactivation that has shown that this replay is probably very important in humans as well. This is done by pairing a certain kind of learning with a certain kind of stimulus, for example, the odor of a rose or a given sound. And this pairment is done during waking, and then when people are in sleep, the odor or the sound is presented, so as the idea is to reactivate the whole memory by priming it with that stimulus. And indeed, this works very well. And depending on the kind of learning, if it's non-emotional, slow wave sleep is the best thing to be targeted. But if you're talking about emotional learning, then REM sleep becomes very important. Okay, so all that pertains to this first part of the Hebbian scheme, the neuronal reverberation part. What about the structural change part? What is known about that? So back in the day, when 1949, he had no idea what the mechanisms could be. Nobody knew. Actually, we didn't even know that the DNA was doing what it does. But nowadays, if we talk about structural change, we're actually talking about synaptic plasticity and neuronal plasticity. And the mechanisms of this plasticity were unraveled in the last 40 years. I wouldn't say that they're completely unraveled, but we know a lot more now. And they have to do with the entry of calcium through an NMDA channels in the postsynaptic terminal of a neuron. And this will activate a cascade of phosphorylation events, when one kind protein will phosphorylate the next one. This is a cascade of protein kinases. And eventually, CREB1, which is a transcription factor, when it gets phosphorylated, goes into the nucleus and promotes the transcription of several genes. Those first genes to be transcribed, to be expressed after the stimulus, are called immediate early genes. You can have RNA accumulation after only 5 minutes of stimulation. You can have peak protein levels after just 1 hour of stimulation. So they're really, really fast. They don't require de novo protein synthesis. And these immediate early genes, and in particular two that I will talk about, ZIF268 and ARC, they're essential for long-term consolidation of memories. If you block their expression using antisense or in knockout mice, animals will learn very well on day one, but they will not remember things on day two. In the case of ARC, it's a so-called effector molecule. It's directly involved in synaptic remodeling, while ZIF268 is a transcription factor, so it will go back into the nucleus and promote the transcription of many other genes, in particular synapsins 1 and 2, which are the most abundant proteins of synapses. So when these genes were discovered in the late 80s and early 90s, the hypothesis was very obvious. It's like, well, if those genes are important for plasticity and learning, and if sleep is related to learning, those genes should be upregulated. Their expression should be upregulated during sleep. And the first to try this hypothesis were Chiara Cirelli and Giulio Tononi, working with Pompeiano, and they found the opposite. They found that when animals were allowed to sleep for many hours undisturbed, the expression of those genes would decrease. What you see here is NGFIA, which is the same thing as ZIF268, it's just a different name for the homolog. And when the animals were kept awake through sleep deprivation, the expression exploded. So basically, this was exactly the opposite of the hypothesis. And this led them to propose that the function of sleep is to decrease the strength of synapses, is to promote synaptic downscaling. So in their hypothesis, the synaptic homeostasis hypothesis, day and night are completely different. During the day, synapses are potentiated, they're strengthened, and then during the night, they become they're weakened so that we can learn again the next day. So reset for the system, okay? More or less at the same time I was doing my PhD, I performed similar experiments. I was actually not aware of their experiments because there was no PubMed that you could use at the time. So it was not so easy to find those papers at the time. And because I was not aware, I did the experiments. And the experiments actually had a different approach. Rather than studying a long period of sleep versus a long period of waking, we focused on specific episodes. And we sorted slow wave sleep and REM sleep. We also did something which was to compare the animals coming from their cages, from the familiar environment, with animals coming from a novel environment. And what we discovered is that, indeed, during slow wave sleep, there's a strong decrease in the expression of inhibitory genes. What I'm showing here is ZIP268, but it happens for other genes as well. But then in REM sleep, there's a dissociation. If the animals came from a familiar environment, they continue with low expression. But if they're coming from a novel environment, there's a reinduction of the gene. And I like to say that this was the first demonstration of a molecular day residue. We followed up on this by replacing the exploration of novel objects with an artificial memory that we created by passing high-frequency current in the hippocampus. This is called long-term potentiation induction. So this is just a summary of the results. And at 9 a.m., we produced the LTP on only one hippocampus so that we could compare the hemispheres. 30 minutes later, you see very clear expression of... Can you see my cursor? No, you can't see it. You have a very clear expression on the right side, on the dentate gyrus. It's like a V, like this, sideways. And then at noon, a few hours later, the expression is gone from the hippocampus, and it's localized to the cortex and also to the lateral dorsal nucleus of the amygdala. And then if you let the animals go through a next cycle of REM sleep, it's further corticalized. So it moves away and away and away from the hippocampus over time. We published that, and then the reviewer said, well, but that's artificial. You're using, you know, long-term potentiation. That's not really memory. At the time, there was this debate. It's no longer... The debate is actually solved now. But then we went back to the more naturalistic approach, having animals explore a novel environment, and we looked for the expression that occurred not after the first or the second or the third REM sleep episodes after that, but after many hours, 4 hours, 28 episodes afterwards in average. And what we found is that indeed the expression of those genes, ARK and ZIP268, was very low during slow wave sleep, as proposed by the whole homeostasis hypothesis, but it was actually reinduced in the cortex and only in the S1 cortex, not in the V1 cortex. It's not like a generalized effect in the cortex. It's specific to the cortex that was stimulated. Over the years, this led us to propose an alternative to the synaptic homeostasis hypothesis, which we dubbed the embossing hypothesis. So what is this embossing hypothesis? It's the notion that sleep is not just decreasing, promoting generalized downscaling, but it's promoting a global downscaling with some localized upscaling. So you have an embossing of a memory trace, and then you end up with a new trace. Across 15 years, two bodies of evidence supported those two theories with different names for those theories. On the left, you have many, many papers by the Baccirelli group and the Tononi group showing that at the molecular level, at the electrophysiological level, at the morphological level, and also some computational studies supporting this notion of synaptic homeostasis during sleep. On the right side, you have many, many publications from several groups, including my own, saying, well, it's not like that because there's evidence of calcium-dependent synaptic upscaling during sleep. And this was a difficult debate because the left side really dominated the field for many years, and they wouldn't really cite the other side. But then at some point, new information came. This came from Wen Biao Gan's lab in New York University. And this was solved by imaging synapses as they are alive, not looking at synaptic sizes after the animals are dead, but looking at the changes in the same animal over time by thinning the skull and imaging those synapses. And what they were able to show is that REM sleep prunes newly formed synapses, so it kills many synapses. In this particular case, it's a motor task, and this is done in the motor cortex. But the REM sleep also strengthens a fraction of the new spines. So it's really a selection process, kills most spines, but saves some of them, and this allows them to survive. More recently, we conducted a phosphoproteomic study in collaboration with Daniel Martins de Souza at the University of Campinas in Brazil. And we looked for what happens right after the animal finishes an episode. So we looked at the expression, and we did this analysis on tissue that was extracted immediately after the animals had an episode of slow wave or REM sleep, and we compared animals that were coming from familiar versus novel environments. And we found that there are many proteins that get to be phosphorylated in a sleep-dependent manner, and in particular, that are correlated with the amount of sleep spindles that occur in the transition between slow wave and REM. So this transition is very important. It's like a trigger for the phosphorylation of those proteins. And we found one protein in particular, which is a voltage-dependent calcium channel, that is significantly downregulated in the hippocampus, but not in the cortex. So this is a candidate for being a mechanism to explain the hippocampal disengagement. Okay, so I've talked about genes, proteins, calcium, kinases. But what about dreams? I mean, this is all about sleep. What does it have to do with dreams? So really, I mean, that kind of weird experience, and I really like those photographs by Grete Stern because they bring this mixture of very regular things of life, prosaic things of life, together with the bizarre things of dreaming. What do we know about that, about those experiences that involve both fear and desire, right? This image here brings both to the foreground. Until very recently, most people in the biomedical field believed that dreaming was not really something interesting enough to be studied. It was not the material of science because it was too subjective. And most people believed, in fact, that you could reduce dreaming to REM sleep. And the first to say that this was not the case, not just with opinions but with some data, was Mark Solms. Mark Solms showed that people that have lesions to the ventral tegmental area, that deep dopaminergic center that sends dopamine to signal reward and punishment, they are able to enter REM sleep, but they are not able to dream. So all of us probably here have this region intact, so you can actually, maybe if you're lucky, can dream of something like that. But if you have a lesion to that area, or to the axons that leave that area, that region, this is the kind of dream you have. Nothing. Another interesting aspect that I want to bring to your consideration is the relationship between psychosis and dreaming. In the late 19th century, the founding fathers of psychiatry, Kraepelin, Bleuler, and Freud, they disagreed on many things, but they agreed on some things. And one thing they really agreed on is that psychosis and dream were related. This idea held for 50 years, until in the 50s when dopaminergic drugs, antagonists of the D2 receptor became known, this whole notion that psychosis was important in terms of the subjective contents was lost, because then it was reduced to a pharmacological problem. And then people stopped talking about that relationship in most places. But, for example, Ernest Hartmann, one of the pioneers of this biological study of dreaming, he didn't really give up on this idea. In this 67 book, he brought this piece of data that compares a hypnogram, so the sequence of sleep states of a healthy subject, with what you would find in a patient with schizophrenia. And you can see there are many intrusions of dreaming sleep, of REM sleep in this patient, suggesting that there's some sort of overlap. Many years later, I was part of a team of researchers at Duke University, led by Kafuit Ziraza, and we decided to follow up on this idea. Actually inspired by the Hartmann result, we decided to investigate sleep and waking in hyperdopaminergic mice, knockout mice for the dopamine transporter. So a regular animal, a normal animal, will have a transporter that brings dopamine inside the presynaptic terminal, so it decreases dopamine levels at the synaptic cleft. But these animals do not have the transporter, so they have the dopamine stays outside, and the animals are, you know, they become, you know, hyperdopaminergic, very active. And what we found is that indeed, in those animals, there is an overlap between the spectral patterns of waking and REM sleep. And if you treat them with haloperidol, with a D2 antagonist, the clusters will separate again. And if you eliminate the dopamine completely, you kill the wake-sleep cycle entirely. So this gave some support to the notion that indeed there is this relationship, an interesting relationship between psychosis and dreaming of hyper dopaminergic and REM sleep, dreaming sleep. A different line of evidence is the investigation that we had in my own lab, and this was the graduate work of Natalia Mota in my lab, in which we investigated the how informative are dream reports when you were trying to diagnose a patient with schizophrenia. In the earlier studies, we compared dream reports with waking reports across subjects with schizophrenia, with bipolar disorder during the manic phase, and also in control subjects and healthy subjects. And when you ask for a waking report, you typically get some chronological account. So every red circle there is a word, and you can see the edges are basically showing you the sequence of the temporal sequence of the phrase. And even though you have some loops in the schizophrenia group, that's not statistically different from the other ones. But when you ask for a dream report, the contrast becomes very obvious. The schizophrenia and bipolar patients are completely different, and the control subjects are in between. We followed up on this by comparing not just dream with yesterday memory, but also reports on negative, positive, and neutral images, and also the oldest memory. And a little bit to our surprise, because I thought the oldest memory was probably going to be like a dream, but it's not. The best thing you can ask, among those categories, the best one you can use to try to diagnose a patient with schizophrenia is indeed the dream report. So Freud was not so off in the end. So let's revisit those statements. He said that dreams contain the residues. We are very safe to say now that dreams reactivate memories at the electrophysiological and molecular levels. He said that dreams are driven by desires and fears. It's fair to say that dreams simulate behaviors and dopamine-mediated expectations of reward and punishment. When he said that dreams are the royal road to the unconscious, maybe we could say that dreams give access to the memory database, promoting creativity and revealing the structure of the dreamer's mind. More recently, in the laboratory of Giulio Tononi, Francesca Ciclari and collaborators published a very important paper in which they investigated the correlates, the EEG correlates, the electroencephalographic correlates of dreaming. And they were able to show that when people are dreaming very vividly, there's a decrease in low-frequency activation and an increase in high-frequency activation between 25 and 50 hertz, so between the beta band and the low gamma band, in a posterior cortical region, actually a very vast region, that is can really predict whether you're dreaming or not. More or less at the same time, we were doing work along the same lines in our lab, but focusing not on REM sleep dreaming, but in N1 hypnagogic dreaming. And we devised this multiple awakenings protocol that goes like this. So you begin the task showing an affective image, an image that has strong emotional content, and also neutral ones to compare. And the person has to give a description. What do you see? And the person gives a description of that, a verbal description of that. And the person also rates the effect. How do you feel about that image? Then we say, please sleep. The person goes to sleep. And then after 5 to 20 minutes, we let the person enter, stay still in awake, or go into N1 sleep or N2 sleep. We wake the person with a beep and say, what do you see? And how do you rate that thing you're seeing? So the person will give you an account. What we notice, and it's very obvious from the data, is that there is a persistence of that image, right? The first description is a shark with an immense mouth and many sharp teeth ready to attack a prey and so on. And the other one is blue, bright blue, so blue, bright with some white parts, and it kept moving. So obviously, it relates to that image, but the menacing part is gone. And what we found, and it's a very strong effect, is that the effects of the original image are neutralized while the image itself reverberates. So there's a neutralization of the emotion, but there's a persistence of the image. We found also that the image residue is positively correlated with high frequency activation on the right hemisphere, very compatible with the findings of Ciclari and Tononi. But they are negatively correlated with theta power, with power in the 5 to 7 hertz band, also in the right hemisphere. The right hemisphere is known to be important for dream, more important for dreaming than the left hemisphere. So the theta rhythm, most of the theta rhythm, if not all, comes from the hippocampus, comes from the interaction between hippocampus and septum. So we hypothesized that this is probably an effect that has to do with the hippocampus. And then Jorge Nascimento and Allan Kardec Barros, two colleagues, Jorge doing his PhD and Allan his supervisor, and I'm the co-supervisor, he spent the past few years transforming those 2D EEG sensor maps into 3D source maps using a technique to infer the source mathematically. And this allowed us to test whether So to test this hypothesis, what is the hypothesis? Could the decrease in recent image residue during hypnagogic sleep, because by competition with pre-existing memories that are powered by theta rhythm from the hippocampus? And this is data that is not published yet. We are under review. And we were able to indeed find activation in the hippocampus that is negatively correlated with image residue and many other results that I will not have time to develop here. But what is very interesting is that those regions that we found, this collection of regions that we found that are correlated with image residue, either positively or negatively, they show a big overlap with the so-called default mode network, the DMN. What is the DMN? It's a collection of brain regions that are activated when you dream, but also when you mind wander, when you produce an autobiographical narrative, when you make an action plan, or when you feel empathy. So this is interesting, right? When you are feeling empathy, you involve the same regions that you engage when you're dreaming. So in a way, to feel empathy, to put yourself in somebody else's position, is like a dream. You're dreaming you're that person. And this has a very important social implication. In a series of studies and several of those published in Matt Walker's lab in California, at Berkeley, have shown that when you have sleep loss, when you had a bad night of sleep, you lose empathy. You become insensitive to other people's pain. And in fact, you feel more distant to other people. Quite literally, the distance, the physical distance that you consider comfortable increases when you lose sleep. So what is the social implication of that in this world in which we can barely sleep quietly? The implication is that our way of life is pulling us apart, right? Since the invention of electric light, and then with the invention of radio, television, and the internet, and now smartphones, our sleep has greatly worsened. We're sleeping less and less. There are many papers showing that. People are sleeping, in some countries, 2 hours less nowadays than they used to sleep 100 years ago. And what is the impact of that on dreaming? It's tremendous, because when you sleep, when you go to sleep late and wake up early, you don't skip the first half of your night. You skip the second half of the night. And this is when REM sleep is enriched. So we're basically killing our dreaming capacity. But it's not just that we are sleeping less and dreaming less. It's also that we don't pay attention to dreams whatsoever. Nobody goes to the workplace or to the school and say, oh, what was your dream today? And if you want to tell your dream to somebody, they don't want to listen, right? We lost contact with this ancient art of dreaming and sharing dreams. And we know that sleep loss is causing tremendous problems, right? Poor sleep is associated with learning disorders, with impaired emotional regulation, with depression, with diabetes, with obesity, with cardiovascular disease. And if you sleep badly for years, you're probably going to develop early Alzheimer's disease. We also know that we are going through a crisis of depression and anxiety in the world. Depending on the country, 30 to 40% of the people are depressed or anxious. And every year, about 700,000 people kill themselves. That's twice the amount of people that are killed by homicide. I wonder what our grand-grand-grand-grand-grand-grand-mother, mammalian ancestor 200 million years ago would think of that. Life was so hard, and now we're killing ourselves. What's going on with us? In the Western world, people were convinced that this was because they had low serotonin, so they had to take antidepressants that increased the amounts of serotonin. And now this theory has been debunked. You can have high serotonin and be depressed. You can have low serotonin and not be depressed. I'm not saying that those substances don't have an effect. What I'm saying is that depression is way more complicated than a level of a neurotransmitter. It has to do with your links, with your relationships, with your purpose in life. And we also know that these antidepressants don't work very well. The effect sizes are small, and in fact, it's marginally above placebo. So this is actually a huge scam. In the past 40 years, the pharma industry has been producing a scam and telling people that rather than fixing their lives, they need to take a drug. There's a lot of hope now, as Stan mentioned, in the use of psychedelics, which also work through the classical psychedelics that work through the serotonergic system to counter this tendency towards depression. And there's strong evidence that ayahuasca, for example, the Amazonian brew, potent Amazonian brew that induces visions, is an antidepressant. This is work done at the Brain Institute where I work by my dear colleague and friend Draulio de Araújo and Fernanda Palhano Fontes in a team of collaborators. It has been shown also for psilocybin and for other psychedelics. And so everybody now there's a huge hype around this that we all should go and replace antidepressants with psychedelic treatment. There are some good reasons to do that because the effects are stronger. You don't need to take them every day. You can take them occasionally. And what would be the mechanism of that? In the past 8 years, there were a bunch of publications showing that those substances activate the same plasticity pathways that are activated by sleep, and you can promote synaptic change, you can promotes even the production of new neurons, and it's a matter of pride for me that about half of those publications are from Brazil. The leading country now in psychedelic research is the US, the second one is the UK, and the third one is Brazil. This is very rare. It doesn't happen often, and we're very happy that this is so. Some of those papers are from my own lab or in collaboration, and from other labs as well. I also studied the effects of ayahuasca with my colleague Draulio on imagery, and we were able to find that when people are under the effect of ayahuasca and they have their eyes closed, they have as strong activation in the visual cortex as if they had their eyes open. There's also activation in the temporal regions around the hippocampus, so you can think of this as activation of the theater, like the visual cortex, and also the characters coming from the temporal regions, activating those, producing those images. And there's also activation in the frontopolar cortex. This is probably related to the instruction to imagine while doing the task. I got really interested in investigating this relationship, the intimate relationship between the psychedelic visions and the dreaming. Because when you take a psychedelic, I will not ask you to raise your hands if you have taken one, but those that have know that if you take a psychedelic, you cannot go to sleep. You won't sleep for hours, okay? Nevertheless, your experience is dreamlike. So what's going on? So we performed experiments. This was the PhD of Annie Costa Souza and also work of her by her brother, Brian Costa Souza, in my laboratory, in the laboratory of Adriano Tocht, in our institute. And basically what she did was to give a potent psychedelic, 5-MeO-DMT, to rats. She also tried with LSD, and the results are the same. And compare those transitions between slow wave and REM in the two conditions. And what we see is in an animal that received saline, they will be transiting from wake to slow wave to REM, but they're only moving when they're awake. This is a speed, this is a plot of speed, and you see they're moving when they're awake and they're not moving when they're sleeping, which is, of course, what you would expect. But if you give them the psychedelic substance, they will continue the cycle. That was the first surprise, because we thought the animals would be in the wake cluster only. They are still going through all the clusters. This is showing here transition directly into REM, which is also something interesting. But they can also go to slow wave sleep, so it's not only REM. Both occur. But what is interesting is that they do so while moving. And you can see there that the colors are not a deep blue. It's a light blue. It means the animals are moving. So if you look at the image, you'll see animals doing those behaviors that are stereotypical of the psychedelic experience. They will walk backwards, the tail will go like this, and they will be overtly awake, but their brains seem to continue the cycle. And now we are working on the hypothesis that when you are experiencing a psychedelic drug, you have three substates, in fact. During some moments, you are very attuned to what's outside, and that would be the wake-like cluster. At some moments, you are more in torpor, you're more like drowsy, and this would be the slow-wave sleep-like cluster. And sometimes you're actually having inner visions, and this would be the REM-like cluster. And so we're exploring that now in humans. I want to finish by bringing it together with a more with the perspective of society. We are living a crisis, right? We cannot deny it. We're living in a world that is becoming increasingly polluted, in which the gadgets and the machines are taking the place of humans, and people are completely addicted to money and to objects, and really suffering from a lack of a purpose and lack of bonds. As we're doing this, we are destroying the environment. The Amazon is burning. Pierre Picard is here, right, Pierre? The Amazon is burning. There's a huge drought. And this is man-made. If we don't do anything, the Amazon is going to be gone. By the time our children are our age, there's going to be no Amazon. We are causing the sixth mass species extinction. And apparently, we cannot stop it. We understand it. Science has been showing to us what's going on. And we can't stop it. We can't even stop the wars. So this is the terrible paradox that we're living. Even though we have an amazing accumulation of knowledge, right? Every day, there's the publication of hundreds, if not thousands of papers. Every day. Even though there's this amazing accumulation of capital, we don't seem to be able to solve the problems, the most simple problems, which have to do with relating to each other, to being tolerant, to being empathetic. And I've been pondering, and I've been saying that this is probably related to our very poor sleeping and very poor dreaming. So we're living in this delusional insomnia that the solutions should be obvious, but we cannot act on them. We cannot do anything about it. We cannot properly act on the imagination of the consequences of our acts. As Stan mentioned, I published a book 5 years ago in which those ideas are presented, and in which I propose a scenario for the evolution of dreaming as a survival neurobiological mechanism. So long dreaming in mammals probably evolved before the big extinction of the KT boundary 66 million years ago. Our ancestors were living in very narrow niches. They were surrounded by huge and terrible dinosaurs, and they really needed to have a cognitive edge. And probably dreaming evolved as what I like to call not a deterministic oracle, as it was believed in the Roman, Greek, and Egyptian societies of 5,000 years, 3,000 years ago, but rather as a probabilistic oracle. Based on yesterday, based on the probabilities of yesterday, what could tomorrow be? And most importantly, what can I do about it? So I would like to finish by proposing that we really need to rescue this ancient art of dreaming, which was not forgotten by indigenous populations. This is a Xavante village seen from above. And you can see it has a semicircular disposition. And right in the center, there is the dream circle, the place where people go every morning to share their dreams, to transform their fears and desires at the individual level into collective solutions. I think that if we are able to sleep well, to say no to the forces of capitalism that want to invade our nights, and protect our sleep, and protect our capacity to dream, and rescue a dream in the morning, share it with the people we love, try to understand their own dreams, share our fears and desires, we probably, using all the knowledge and all the capital has been accumulated, we can make this planet a better place. And I think this is a dream worth sharing. Thank you very much for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-2-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.